Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer at Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning at Morningstar.
Our guest this week is Martin Lau. Martin is a managing partner of FSSA Investment Managers, part of First Sentier Investors. He's been at the firm since 2002 and is the lead fund manager of various FSSA strategies, including the FSSA Asian Equity Plus Fund, the FSSA China Growth Fund, and the FSSA Hong Kong Growth Fund. Martin has been in the investment business for nearly three decades and is based in Hong Kong. Morningstar's analysts have recognized Martin's achievements on a number of occasions, most recently in 2020 when they named the FSSA Hong Kong Growth Fund the winner of the Best Hong Kong Equity Fund Award. Martin earned a Bachelor of Arts degree from Cambridge University, as well as a Master's degree in Engineering from Cambridge. Martin is a CFA charter holder. Martin, welcome to The Long View.
Yep, thank you, Jeff.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're a very accomplished investor, but might not be as familiar to some of our listeners here in the U.S. You were trained as an engineer, but found your calling in managing portfolios. So to get started, can you talk about how you began your career in investment management?
Yep. Thanks, Jeff, for the time and also for the question. I think you're right. So when I went to university, I didn't think about becoming a fund manager. In fact, I chose, as you said, engineering. I studied in the UK. I studied at Cambridge. So when I first went there, I was just thinking I like mathematics. I like analyzing things and I like building things, not necessarily building portfolios, but building, you know, bridges and robots and things like that. So I started with engineering. I guess when I was in university, and as you know, Hong Kong was and still is a financial center. So I started to develop an interest in more like management and financial stuff. So as the university years progressed, I was moving myself more to kind of economics, management and statistics and things like that. At Cambridge, it was and still is a pretty flexible course in terms of the things that they taught at that time. So it was really random. And of course, when I graduated, I was really thinking about what impact could I have, you know, both on myself, maybe a bit financially and maybe a bit like the opportunities. In Hong Kong, there were and there are still not as many opportunities from the engineering side. So it's not Hong Kong, it's not like the US, Silicon Valley, et cetera, as you probably know. So I just started with fund management. And I guess one of the things which I was attracted to it was it's a very transparent. So basically, I didn't and still don't have any kind of networks and relationship. And I'm actually from a relatively or very normal family. So I think, you know, it just struck me as a career where if you put in the effort, your results are actually very transparent. And of course, over the years, I've been blessed as in, you know, China actually emerged. When I joined the industry, you know, China was basically 0% of the world index. So that was before China started opening up. And as of today, of course, China is probably 10-15% of the world index. So it's been a very rewarding process. And I would say the other thing which I was attracted to was basically it's a very people-driven industry. I guess there are not that many people. First of all, within the fund management firm, so it's not like your engineering firm where you might have, you know, hundreds of engineers or thousands of engineers. And it's a very people-concentrated, people-driven industry. And so you've got the opportunity to interact with not just very talented, you know, colleagues or team members, but more importantly, you've got the chance to talk to, say, CEO. When I just graduated, I had the chance to talk to different CEOs, chairman, CFO, etc. So in the very early years, I've got exposure to talk to very interesting people. And I think that has been, even up to today, a very interesting and enjoyable part of my career.
What formative experiences or professional influences shaped you into the investor that you are today?
Yes, that's a very good question, Christine. So I would say, you know, I think that's probably partly because I was trained as an engineer and partly because I'm Chinese. So I'm more sensitive to numbers. And I would say the training from engineers is not so much the accuracy of the number itself. So often, you know, a mathematician might come up with like two decimal places And for engineers, if someone with engineering background is listening to this call, they would agree it's probably the about right kind of number is often sufficient. So I think that kind of sensitivity to numbers, and also the, I guess the another thing which I kind of observed over the years is often is about common sense. So you might build a lot of models, and you might calculate, and you might hire a rocket scientist and things like that. But then ultimately, if you look back to past 10, 20 years, and often it's obvious with hindsight, but often when you look back, a lot of things are pretty obvious. Things like when you saw, say, for example, a lot of subprime mortgages in the US, when you saw there was a long queue or people were rushing to do certain things like during the tech bubble or, to buy a China stock. And often that observation, and I guess the sensitivity to numbers, have really helped my career over the years. And I would say the more so on that one is, I think often in our industry, we have a lot of extremely talented people. And I would say most of them are actually more clever than myself. So I guess it's more about how you try to pull yourself, backwards and have more thoughts about what's going on and take a more, distant observation on the markets and things like that. So I think those would be, I would say, would be some of the influences on myself, basically starting off as an engineer.
I wanted to shift and talk about a form of engineering, which you alluded to before, which is portfolio construction. If someone who knew nothing about you was trying to surmise your investment philosophy and style only by examining the portfolios you manage, what do you think is the most telling thing they'd observe? And then the other hand, what do you think they would find that's meaningful for its absence?
Mm, yes. So first of all, starting from day one, we have had this belief when we started the team together about 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago. It's actually more like 25, 30. So basically, we wanted to make sure that, first of all, when we build a portfolio, we build it as if we are doing it with our own money. So basically, we look at the portfolio as a steward of our own and our clients' capital. So what I mean is, unless you are really confident about something, you shouldn't really do it. I mean, it's not about, I mean, often in the investment world, you have a lot of feeling, especially in relative terms, you feel that you should buy some, let's say, Tesla, because other people have got lots of Tesla and Tesla share prices going up, for example. So I think we make sure when we build the portfolio, it's based on conviction. It's based on if you do with your own money, what would you do? And also another thing that we do on that note is that we don't look at the index. And in fact, if you look at our portfolios across the board for FSSA, we typically have an active share of more than 90%. In fact, we have been very proud over the years, as in we haven't owned certain stocks in the market, which at one point might have gone up, let's say, 10 times and subsequently fell by 90%. And I think in portfolio management, when you try to construct a portfolio, over the years, what we've learned is also that performance not just come from what you own, but the longer you try to draw the time horizon, it's more about what you don't own. So the fact that you manage to avoid certain pitfalls and certain bubbles along the way. As I said, often when you look back, a lot of things are very, very obvious with hindsight. And I think the other thing which when we build the portfolio, we also want to come with an ESG perspective. And we are not saying this because nowadays people talk about it a lot. So what we have always told our team members is when you invest into your portfolio, it's not just about the return. It's about whether this is the right thing to do. And it's also about your responsibility as a shareholder. So I guess, if someone asks me, explain your portfolio, we typically can explain very much as in why we own them, why we want to be shareholders of them, not just because of the attractiveness of their businesses, but also because why we believe they are responsible companies in their respective fields. And also when people ask about our weighting, and again, we can very easily explain as in we are more confident about this stock, in different ways. And therefore, we have a higher weighting rather than just saying that we are 2% overweight or 3% overweight, etc. So I think these are the things that we typically do when we construct our portfolios.
We're going to dive into other aspects of how you run money. But before we do that, we should discuss China. You're a seasoned investor in the Chinese stock market, which has sold off in recent months. I believe you've said that the best time to invest in Chinese stocks is when everyone thinks they're bad. So is this one of those times? And if so, what has your team done in response?
Yes, that's a very timely question. And thanks for that, Christine. I think you're right. So I've always, first of all, I'm Chinese myself. And as I said, I was educated overseas. And I would say half of my brain is kind of Chinese and half of my brain is kind of Western, if you want to call it that way. And typically, I would find it quite interesting that, you know, from time to time, let's say the Western world, and put it this way, a lot of the marginal investments into China are still driven by foreign capital. So the Western world, typically, we have some kind of imagination on China. Once every, I would say, 3 to 4 years. So just before 2 months ago, the consensus was pretty much positive across the board. So if you ask people, at the end of last year, what are the best investment opportunities in the whole world? And quite a few of them, and including some of the very famous tech investors in the US, they would say, China. So they would say, China electric vehicles, China internet, China delivery, internet platforms, they are as strong as the US ones, and, et cetera, et cetera. And so the consensus was pretty much buying China. And that was on the back of China being the best performing market last year. And if you count the Asia markets, China has been the best performing markets globally for 2 years in a row up to the end of last year. So the Western view or the general view on China typically move in a cycle. So of course, after a few months and triggered by some regulations on internet and lately regulation on the education industry, the sentiment took a U-turn. Basically, if you ask people, actually, I was talking to someone yesterday and he was comparing China to Russia. And with all due respect to, those people from Russia, they're saying basically that you basically cannot rely on, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and there's so much political risk. And basically, you should just forget about the market. And yesterday, we saw a huge selling by foreign investors. So I can understand that. As I said, I've kind of, if you want to call it half Chinese and half Westerner. So from my point of view, China has never been as great as you think. And China is probably not as bad as you think also. So my view is, regulation has always been there. I mean, does it surprise you that the Chinese government is a very strong government and probably has become stronger in recent years, as you can see from the interactions that China has had with other countries? And China has always been very top-down and interventionist. And to be fair, the Ant Financial thing happened in the middle of last year. So I think people are all of a sudden waking up to the fact that there's actually top-down policy risk. From our perspective, the fact that markets are aware of risk is a positive, and the same thing goes with the inflation interest rate. You might think, we never have a view as in whether interest rate is going to rise and how much and when, and if we do, we have been wrong for 10 years anyway. But we often feel whenever markets are concerned about inflation, concerned about interest rates, and now concerned about China, it is actually a good thing, because at the end of the day, the best time to buy a market or to buy something is when the risk premium is high, when people don't actually believe in certain things. So I do think compared to, let's say, 1 or 2 months ago, now is a better time to buy China. But then, as in whether you should buy China, instead of other things, you can debate. But we've always held the view that, as I said, we are long-term investors and we focus on companies. If we say the same company that we've always liked, everything being equal, if the share price, let's say, over the last few days has fallen 20%, everything being equal, it is actually more attractive. The risk reward is actually better to buy the same stock today as compared to, let's say, 2 weeks ago. So I think this is actually the time to test our confidence or investors' confidence. And in fact, yesterday when we had our investment meeting, actually, whenever people are scared or whenever things are uncertain, like last year with COVID, it's often the time to test your confidence on the stocks that you actually own. We are a strong believer that share prices follow earnings. So if you tell me today that you are very confident about a company whereby the earnings would be, let's say, 50% higher in 5 years' time compared to today, and today is actually quite attractively valued, I would say the return from that stock would have very little to do with whether China is tackling one or two industries today. So you really, at the end, you need to believe share prices follow earnings. And basically, we are bottom-up investors. We try to find companies that we believe that is going to be the case.
That all makes sense. I did want to ask, though, if any of the assumptions that you might have made formerly about the state of the public private partnerships, so to speak, in China, whether those have changed in any ways that's had implications on the way you pick stocks or structure the portfolio. It sounds like you're still relatively sanguine, and I think that you were sanguine even earlier in the year when regulators were cracking down on some of the monopolistic practices in the e-commerce space. I think that you had pointed out it was already quite competitive, and if it grows, and even if growth slows, it could spell for larger profits for the players in that space. And so I don't know if you feel the same way or whether you think that the recent events that have unfolded have changed that thinking, even in somewhat modest ways.
Yes. I guess our views on this public-private partnership, or to describe it in another way, let's say state-owned companies versus private companies, over the years has actually changed. So when I first started looking at China, it was basically all state-owned companies. So it was everything was controlled by the state. Almost all the listed companies are Chinese companies. And then the problem is, of course, the misalignment of interest, the lack of incentive. And often state-owned companies are typically more focused on expansion or revenue rather than return and profitability or shareholders. And then the private companies started to emerge, the likes of Alibaba, Tencent, and actually many more on top of that. And typically they are entrepreneurial, they are more driven, they are more focused on return. It's their own business, so they actually care about cash flow and return and everything. And of course, from time to time, they took too much risk. And of course, from time to time, there were also government intervention. And if you look back to the past, you know, even before internet happened, it was actually quite common that certain businessmen, let's say, got arrested and subsequently the business failed. So I guess the way that, you know, for many years, we were actually looking for entrepreneurs and strong private companies that are driven with the right culture. They want to achieve something and build something in China. And to a large extent, let's say if you look at Tencent, which we've been a shareholder since 2005, and then basically it's been a phenomenal achievement. You can see results, you know, growing from a small company into a gigantic company. So, I mean, the process has been extremely rewarding. However, I guess over the last 2 years, we're starting to see some changes, and these changes happened before the recent scare over the intervention. What we've seen is, first of all, I would say the companies have become very big. So if you look at Didi, they dominate the ride sharing. If you look at e-commerce, Alibaba dominated and still dominate, you know, the e-commerce space with 70% plus market share. And I think what we've seen is, first of all, there's a question about dominance, even without the intervention from the government. Where is the extra room for growth? So we have been looking at, let's say, the results from Apple, which just announced results last night, and results from Google, etc. They all reported pretty decent results. However, if you look at the Chinese companies, even before the Chinese government intervention recently, they are starting to see some margin pressure because there are quite a number of big companies and they've been competing with each other when China already has more than 1 billion e-commerce or internet users. So basically, you know, China just have 1.3 billion people. So you are really competing for the very marginal extra, you know, new users, and it become very, very competitive. So I would say before that, we have been thinking about the whole thing. And I think from the intervention, what we've also seen, and I think this intervention is also cyclical, and I'm going to explain that later. But what we've seen is Chinese government for many years, people would say Chinese government is actually the most capitalist, even though they call themselves, you know, socialist or communist. And they're very pro-business. And basically, you know, when Deng Xiaoping, which is the first leader who opened up China, said you need to let a small group of people to become wealthy first. And then that really triggered all the reforms, etc. But then in recent years, I would say become more socialist. I would say this is actually not just a China phenomenon. It's probably a global phenomenon as well. The government start to question more about the rights of employees, the right of workers, the right of small businesses. And therefore, you see all these kind of measures which are targeted at the more monopolistic companies. So I would say this is actually quite a big change. And I would say this is going to stay for quite some time. When I say this is cyclical, I guess for all governments, economies, and things like that. So these things come in cycles. So when we started off, you probably have very little regulation and certain companies became very, very successful. And then whenever companies become big, of course, the politicians or the government would start to concern, and this is a global phenomenon also. And also they would start to kind of regulate, intervene, etc. When they overdo it, if there's a case that, you know, they have already overdone a bit, and then they will observe the market, they observe the capital being raised, and subsequently capital being raised is still important for the economy. And then they would also adjust. So I think the regulators are also learning along with investors as to how to adjust for the new kind of thing that some of these companies have become so big. So my view on this one is it's an ongoing thing. The education regulation was a surprise even to us. So it has been like very, very strict. So I guess that's also a wake-up call, as in for people to look at China, you know, there are certain risks which are attached to China because China is a very top-down country still. So I think investors will still adjust and just move forwards.
You define risk as permanent loss of capital. That's increasingly uncommon in the fund world, where relative measures of risk like standard deviation or tracking error are more dominant. Why did you decide that that was the right approach to take?
Yeah, so as I started out, you know, we encourage people to look at our portfolios as our own money. So if you manage your own money, what you care most is basically a steady capital appreciation on a decent, attractive risk-adjusted basis. You probably don't care about the benchmark, and you probably don't care about, tracking error, which is relative volatility versus the benchmark. So I think that that's the case. And also another thing what we've observed over the years is when we start to pick companies one by one from a really bottom-up perspective without any reference to the benchmark, we subsequently found that, first of all, our portfolios are actually less volatile than the benchmark. You know, so again, if you say, if some people define risk as in, try to reduce your relative risk to the benchmark, and if the benchmark itself is more volatile, you're kind of wondering why you're trying to reduce risk by following something which is even more risky or volatile than yourself. So I think the other thing is, I guess if you try to reduce that, the tracking error, we've always believed the benchmark is the last thing that you look at. And I think for the fixed income world, it's probably easier to see it that way. Basically, we've tried to follow the fixed income index. You're trying to buy more of those debt of the most indebted companies. So, you know, by definition, if you owe more money, you have a higher benchmark weighting, and you should buy more of that. It doesn't make any common sense. And the same with the index. And if you look at the China index, if you look back to the last, 15 years, PetroChina, it might sound quite surprising. Now I tell you that PetroChina about 10 years ago was actually the largest stock in China and also one of the largest stocks in the world. And that was when oil price was like $150 and above. And if you look at the end of last year, you know, oil was probably about 1% of the MSCI China. So if you try to follow the index and try to buy into PetroChina thinking that you are reducing the risk for your clients or for yourself, because you're following the benchmark, you basically would have lost a lot of money. And the same with ICBC, used to be the largest, and China Mobile used to be the largest. And there's a rule of thumb, at least in the China universe, and I think this is also a global, you can also apply that as well. Whenever a company becomes the largest in China, you need to be really concerned. It happened with China Mobile, it happened with PetroChina, it happened with ICBC, and last year it happened with Alibaba. So I think there's really no reason why you should follow the benchmark and try to look at tracking error and things like that. So it has always been the approach, and I think we've proven, hopefully, and I think we have, that approach has actually generated a very steady return, you know, over the years.
Yeah, it is remarkable. And actually, one of the things that's most striking, and I could be wrong about this, is that your portfolios tend to be pretty fully invested. I think when Christine and I think about absolute return-oriented equity investors, they tend to have a big slug of cash in the portfolio. It's just always there, that anchor of cash that's in the portfolio. But that hasn't tended to be true of your portfolios. Furthermore, when I look at the portfolio, you know, while they're high quality businesses, they're not screamingly cheap, at least not from a value purist standpoint. So I wondered if you could talk about how you build risk management into security selection and portfolio construction. I would imagine that one of the things that you probably feel like you do to fortify the portfolio is editing out all of those things in the benchmark that you don't want to own because they don't pass your screens. But what about the things you do own when it comes to security selection, portfolio construction? How do you fortify the portfolio against loss of capital?
So first of all, the cash, I think you're right. So I would say that's partly personal behavior. So often when I look at cash, it's a derivative of what you think about the markets. Basically, if you find a company which you believe can generate good return over the next 5 years, we take a 5 year and above views on every single company, that by definition, especially under the current interest rate environment, would outperform cash. So of course, alongside with that would also be risk. So the cash is a derivative, and it's basically a function of whether you find the sufficient number of companies that can generate absolute return over 5 years. So the result of that has been, you know, I've had very little cash over the years. Another thing which I've also learned, and of course you're right, I mean, cash can be can preserve capital when markets fall. But what I, at least based on my experience, and what we found is we basically have very little ability to time the markets. Basically, if you look at, I mean, if, I'm sure you can get this data from all the fund managers that you monitor, I would suspect that the cash level is actually a coincidental indicator versus the market. So whenever you are concerned, and then you raise your cash level, and then by the time you maximize your cash level, that's basically the trough of the market. So I would argue there's relatively little value added from managing the cash. And finally, what we've also found, and this is a more philosophical question. So when our clients, let's say they buy the China fund or the China fund that I manage, they have already taken the view that they want to invest in China. So typically in a client meeting, and then we want to scare the clients as much as possible. So we want to persuade them like China is the last thing that you want to buy. If they still have made up the decision that they want to buy into China, you know, after listening to all the scary stories that we've told them, in a way, we shouldn't really hold cash on their behalf because they have already made the decision that they want to allocate us usually a small percentage of their portfolio into China. So I think that's also a philosophical part, and we charge fee on everything, the whole portfolio, and whether you should really be holding cash when your client has already decided that they want to invest into a sub-regional market. So with that aside, and I think you are also right, as in after you are fully invested and generally valuation is not attractive, as we all know, and how do you try to minimize risk, or how do you try to look at risk if you're already fully invested? I think that's a very good question. First of all, I would say there's always a point about diversification. So let's look at the market today. And the market, I mean, education stocks have fallen 99%. And, you know, let's say internet and some of the software as a service companies have fallen by, let's say, 30-40%. At the end of last year, when you looked at the portfolios, you know, our peers' portfolios and, you know, et cetera, you'll be surprised how similar they are. Basically, for the last 2 years, it's been a competition for how much technology shares you actually own, or how much high growth stocks you actually own. I mean, your performance is a function of how many electric vehicles, how many Meituan, and how much, you know, some of the most popular stocks that you own. And you see everyone being very concentrated into a small number, roughly 5 to 10 names, and everyone is doing the same thing. So I guess you can, you know, if you look at our portfolio, we've always believed the portfolio should be, you know, reasonably diversified. So you can actually reduce your risk by diversification, as in whether value and, you know, downside protection. That's also a very interesting question. So definitely, by definition, a lower valued, you know, a cheaper stock would have a less downside protection. But then, you know, because of the very low interest rate for more than 10 years now, anything with a decent quality, the chance is that it's not as cheap as before. So when we build a portfolio, we really look at every stock individually, and we come up with what we call the fair market values. So we take a 5 year out view and then look at them individually and try to look at the upside and downside. But you're right. I mean, if you look at the valuation as a whole, it's not as cheap as, let's say, compared to 10 years ago.
We wanted to switch over to discuss investing in high quality companies. Would you say competitive advantages are as durable now as they were before? And if they're not, how has that changed the way that you pick stocks and manage risk in your portfolios?
Yes, thanks a lot, Christine, for that question. So I think our view on competitive advantage is, and the way that we define them is actually durable. So whenever we look into a company, one of the key thing that we look at, let's say a financial company or bank, is the competitiveness or the cost of their funding. So which we believe is the by far the most important for a bank. And typically, if you look at such competitive foundation, let's say for a bank, let's say if JP Morgan, I'm just making up a name here, or Wells Fargo, have a low funding cost. It's a very, and the same goes with you know, China Merchants Bank, which is one of our major holdings. It's actually very sustainable. So it's related to your branch networks and it's related to your customer base and a lot of factors go into that. And it doesn't really change that much. And the same goes with, let's say we go to buy a manufacturer and there are plenty of manufacturers in China, as you know. China is actually a manufacturing country. We would typically look at their cost base as compared to their peers. So usually because of scale or because of management and because of the way that they look at processes and apply technology, etc., it is also quite durable. And I think, of course, there are certain competitive edges. So I think the least durable, and we've never invested based on that, is probably something which is, first of all, quite unproven or quite new. Let's say, with some of the, I'm just making this up, but let's say video streaming, which is a recent phenomenon last 2 years. There's a very popular company, which is Douyin or the TikTok, you know, in the US. And there's actually another company which just recently, you know, listed called Kuaishou, which is also about video streaming. Because of the short history for both the companies and also for the industry itself, it is a lot more difficult to judge on the competitive foundation, how durable it is, because there's simply not enough data points for you to make that decision. And usually for our investment process, as I say, we are relatively conservative. We take individual views on stocks. We just, if we are not certain about the competitive advantage, we would simply not buy. Another advantage that we have identified in China over the years, which we have never invested or relied upon, is the advantage based on some kind of licensing or some kind of relationship. So, you know, as you said, the policy keep changing. So you might have a good relationship. Less common these days, but in the past, you know, some businessmen could build a very big business based on a strong relationship with somebody in China or other countries. And you never know. I mean, with that kind of relationship or licensing change, you basically have nothing else to rely upon. And we have observed this in India and in other emerging markets too. So that's the last thing that you want to build your investment case upon. But usually, if you build upon it on some kind of cost, as I said, with banks and with manufacturers, it's quite sustainable. And then last thing that I want to highlight is also the, you know, when we invest, we also look at the people a lot. If there's one thing that is the most important when we make our investment decision, it's actually on the people. So often we look at the reasons behind the cost competitive advantage, and then usually it's related to some kind of management who are really forward-looking, you know, who are really nimble, who's actually no innovative in terms of mindset, know how to apply technology, would never feel complacent, and also we would also feel relatively comfortable that they are actually our stewards. So we rely upon them to kind of keep changing so that their competitive advantage can be maintained.
You mentioned the importance of management. I know that's something that you and your team spend a lot of time analyzing, evaluating. It's pretty apparent from your holdings which management teams you hold in high esteem. But maybe you could talk about an example of a name that you think is exceptionally well managed, but just hasn't gotten cheap enough for you to justify taking a big stake. Are there any stocks that jump to mind that fit that description?
Yeah, so there are actually quite a lot of strong management teams in China. And I think China, as of this stage of the development, as you know, China basically, the stock market basically happened about 30 years ago. So as I said, when I started off investment, I was lucky enough to be among the first generation of fund managers in China. But what I'm trying to say is China still have a lot of first generation entrepreneurs, the likes of, you know, Steve Jobs, if that makes any sense. So they're really driven. They're really capable. Sometimes they take excessive risk. And sometimes they don't agree with what they do. But there are actually quite a number of such companies. And by definition, if you look at our top holdings, and because, as I say, we build everything from a conviction perspective, and we say we focus most on people, the top 10 holdings will reflect the companies whereby we believe have the strongest management team. I will use one example of the top 10 holdings, and one example, as you say, too expensive and maybe, you know, if it gets cheaper, then we can have a chance. So among the top 10 holdings, there's a company. I wouldn't use the common ones like Tencent because that's too boring. There's a holding called ENN Energy. So when you look at the company, and we've been a shareholder for more than 15 years, you look at the company and say, oh, why are you looking at energy? It's basically a natural gas distributor. And the reason why we like it is basically the company keep evolving. So they started off, as a natural gas distributor, and over time they have evolved into different kind of energy solutions. And lately, there's this question as in, you know, what's the future of fossil fuels and whether renewable energies will take over the world and hydrogen, etc. As we keep engaging with the company, because we are shareholders, and discuss with them, we just find that they constantly think about what could be the next challenge and what could be the next opportunity. And over the last few years, they have built a business called the Integrated Energy Solution business, which I won't go into details because this is not the right forum to talk about details. But that kind of mindset of constantly worrying about the trend and, you know, constantly thinking about the opportunity, etc., and doing so over the course of the last 15, 20 years, make us really believe in the management. Another thing is, of course, as we engage with this company over the years, they listen. So they are very forthcoming in terms of discussing and accepting mistakes, etc. So a bit like fund managers, you probably want someone who constantly reflect and learn from their mistakes. So it's a company that we have a lot of confidence on. I would highlight one which is more on the expensive side, but you know, if it falls, then maybe it's more interesting. We are actually shareholders in a small way. So there's a company called Anta Sports. I mean, we have looked at Nike and how successful Nike has become and over the years. And of course, there are many, many books written on Nike. I mean, we've constantly thought about what could be the Nike in China. And of course, as of today, Nike in China is still Nike. So the most popular sports brand. We do think that's going to change over the course of the next 10, 20 years. We believe that's a function of national pride, which is, of course, is, you know, for good and for bad, is has been increasing in China. And you look at Anta Sports, they've actually done a lot of good things over the years. They've made a number of good acquisitions. They acquired probably too much in the details and into something called the Amer Sports. They acquired some really strong brands in the world, like Columbia, like Wilson, and try to introduce them into China. They've done it with Fila, which is also a very successful brand in China. And being from the US, you probably would find it quite difficult to understand because I know Fila is not as strong in the US. So it's a company that would have done quite a few big strategic moves, which make a lot of sense over the years and has got a phenomenal track record since the company was founded. But then become the price. So as of today, it's actually more like 40 to 45 times, depending on which year you're looking at. And sportswear is a very, very popular industry for investor at the moment. So we are a little bit mindful about that. But in terms of the management, I would actually put it right up there along with maybe another 10, 20 companies in China.
Our colleagues shared that one of the things that impresses them about you is your hunger to learn new things. You're not complacent. Can you talk about how you go about determining areas of study and the ways in which you would try to avoid confirmation bias intruding on that process?
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks a lot for the compliment and from your colleagues. So I think the confirmation bias, first of all, is a very interesting comment. So what we found, and we discussed about this yesterday, is, you know, basically, if you talk to industry experts, you talk to analysts, often you try to find data points and evidence that support your own view. So let's say we have had some study on the education sector, for example, in the past, and we look back to the past analysis, is inevitably you are basically, because you're part of the system, you're actually being affected by what's going on at that point in time. And also you try to talk to people that want to confirm your view. So I think that's a very common behavior for fund managers. As for myself, so I think the good thing about, and I think, well, first of all, the challenge rather for myself being not a young fund manager, is that there are so many new things. So I just talked about video streaming, and I needed to go to my colleague, and I deliberately put two youngest colleagues within our team sitting next to me so that I can look at how they do video streaming. How actually one of them set up a shop in Pinduoduo to sell stationery, but not from the company, from her own pocket, just for fun. And by doing so, you actually learn about how young people behave. And I think it's fair to say the best business opportunities come from, you know, younger people. So I think that's how I guess I try to learn. There are also so many new industries that I have never come across myself. So when I was younger, it was all about banks and properties and consumer companies. And these days, you have biologics, you have technology, and to complicate it further, you add electric vehicles. And to complicate it further, in electric vehicles, there are different types of battery technologies and different types of components. And to complicate it even more further within the components, there are like wet type, dry type, and different type of separators. So I think the challenge, and I would say this as a team, is how to constantly learn along the way, absorb new things, and assimilate all those new things. Often the new things could be a bit of noise, so assimilate all those data and new things, and subsequently and finally make an investment decision. So the yes, I think learning is very important. How I try to do that, I don't know. I mean, look, I have three kids, so that helps a bit. And say, for example, so recently I bought a book. I just bought it yesterday, and basically it talks about like an easy way to understand different sciences. It's a very popular book. I cannot tell you the name off my head because I'm a bit nervous now. So I hope by reading that, I would have a some kind of understanding. And usually fund managers, you don't need to have really, really deep understanding. You need to have some understanding of different things. I also, before last year, I read a book about medicine, and I bought one of these pocket diction encyclopedia from Oxford Press, basically around 200 pages on maybe 100, a small book on medicine. And I try to understand, you know, why, what's the difference between biologic drugs versus chemical drugs, and what is the difference between alcohol and drugs. You know, actually alcohol used to be drugs, and opium and things like that, cocaine and things like that. And that helps me to have a actually quite a useful understanding of different, you know. Then I start to understand a few of the companies that we were invested into a bit more, because I'm an engineer and, you know, electrical, you know, geotechnical. I've never studied much into biology. And so I think, you know, by reading more, it also helps, but, you know, different ways.
For our last question, for all your team's talents, how do you work with it to form a collective understanding of what its strengths and limitations are?
Yes, that's a very good question. And in fact, you know, with COVID, and I'm not sure about America, in COVID, what happened is that, you know, people start working from home. And within our team, we have 25 people, and we have people from 9 different countries. And most of our team members have not seen their family for 1.5 years. Why I'm saying this is I think the all along, we have always been proud to have a very stable team. And I think that has been one of the most differentiating factor between us and our competitors. And, you know, as you know, fund managers often, when they feel they're capable, they leave and set up their own companies, et cetera, et cetera. So we haven't seen much of that happening. So I think the strength and weakness of our team is, I mean, let's call up the strength first. We've always tried to maintain an interesting mix and balance within the team. You mentioned about confirmation bias. And I think within the HR kind of world or psychology world, there's a tendency that you hire people who are like yourself and who agree with yourself. And if you're Chinese, you hire Chinese. If you're American, you hire American. If you're Indian, you hire Indian, etc. So you try to hire people that make you more comfortable, because they keep saying that you've done a good job and well done you and things like that. And what we've done is we probably try to maintain an interesting mix, and we don't want the team to be too Chinese. We don't want the team to be too Asian. I mean, they start to say that Asian and Chinese are no good. But then you probably want some of the different perspective. As I say, typically market is a combination of different perspectives. Some, let's say China, a Western perspective on China and a Chinese perspective on China. So that has always been our strength. And from time to time, our you know, some of our, let's say, less knowledgeable colleagues on China would remind us of the risk in China. Let's say education. If you're not from China, you would actually find it very difficult to invest into education. And the reason for that is basically you cannot find another company anywhere in the world, probably with the exception of India, which is, there's a company called Baijiu, which is up and coming. I mean, like tutoring, I mean, is it not a fragmented industry? I mean, is it fair to say that, you know, well, how can you extrapolate certain growth, et cetera, et cetera? So it helps. And it's in the challenges and witness. It's also that because we encourage everyone to debate, and we encourage everyone to be different, to speak their minds. Often we call ourselves butterflies. So we're like, we're not very organized. We ask everyone to be different. When you have 10 butterflies in the room, it's probably quite beautiful. When you have 10 butterflies or monkeys in the room, it's probably become quite difficult to manage. And if 30, you probably want to jump out of the building. So I think it's also been a challenge, and especially with the COVID, working from home. How do you maintain the trust and communication within the team? It's a very soft thing. So I think ultimately, you know, fund management, as I started earlier, is about a small group of people, how you trust each other and work with each other and try to establish the common sense that maneuver you through different bubbles and cycles and fear and greed and et cetera. So I think we've been quite lucky, as in we've got a very stable team that we believe we trust each other. We just had a dinner together last night. So at least up to last night, it was okay. And by the way, Hong Kong is not too bad with COVID, so we could actually do that. And so I think, you know, maintaining that would be a challenge. And that has always been the case.
Well, Martin, this has been a very enlightening discussion. Thanks so much for sharing your perspective and insights with our audience. It's really been great. Thank you again.
Yep, thank you, Jeff. Thanks, Christine, for your time also.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number 1.
And at Christine_Benz.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decisions.